also his two guests, his daughters are here as well, which is nice too.
Well, hello everybody. It's an extraordinary time to be meeting, historical and extraordinary time to meeting. And I think it's very appropriate that we're going to be talking about, among other issues, about cultural change and that are occurring in the world, which has been one of the main themes of Miguel Basaña's work. So I want to start at a more personal level by telling all of you how I met Miguel and what a big surprise it was. Last year, I was invited to be one of the main speakers for the Spanish chapter of IARPP, the International Association of Relational Psychotherapy and Psychoanalysis. And and my talk was about how there's been a radical change in terms of how we think about what made us human and the human condition. And the talk was about how, what if the implications were that for psychoanalysis, and psychoanalysis in particular. So to my big surprise, which I didn't know, there was a pre-conference that was organized by Ramon Riera, who's a very well-known Spanish psychoanalyst from Barcelona, who had been president of the Spanish chapter of IARP, and he invited Miguel Basañez. And their talk was all about cultural values in the world and changes in cultural values in the world in psychoanalysis. That was a very pleasant surprise because it fit very well with the whole theme of what we were going to be talking about. The second big surprise was that he turned to be a fellow Mexican. and so we had a lot to talk about. We both graduate from the same alma mater. And our paths have gone in very different directions. But nevertheless, we have been coinciding in a whole lot of interest as we had plenty of time to talk in Sevilla, where this conference was last year. So just this brief introduction about how my pleasant surprise of meeting Miguel in Sevilla last year. So I just want to say a little bit about Miguel. He's a professor of culture and development at the Fletcher School of Tufts University and at the Kent School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. He's really had three careers, as he explained to me, a career in the Mexican government, a career in public opinion, and a career in an academic career. After graduating from UNAM, as a lawyer, Miguel? Yeah, as a lawyer, he became a Fulbright visiting professor at the University of Michigan and received his PhD and his Master in Philosophy and Political Sociology from the London School of Economics. He is author of 13 books, including the book he will be talking about, The World in Three Cultures. He's had a very distinguished role in government, in the Mexican government. In 1988, he helped the expansion of democracy in Mexico by doing the first opinion surveys that were ever done in the country in 1988. So he was pollster for the president of Mexico. He was general attorney of the state of one of important state of Mexico. He was the chief of staff of the Secretary of Energy, and his last important post with the Mexican government was as ambassador of Mexico to United States. So I'm not going to talk any more about his curriculum. And I just want to say a few things about his talk today. I asked him how he got to this whole idea of the world in three cultures, achievement and joy. And it has a very interesting history. He joined the World Value Survey group in 1990. Now, the World Value Survey, which a lot of his work is based on, is an extraordinary empirical base that have been surveying changes in values in the world now for several decades, I believe, and each time it's become more comprehensive, included, and now includes all the world, if not most of the world. So he first joined the World Value Survey in 1999 to examine empirically the values that separate Catholics from Protestants. And from this empirical basis, he made his first distinction between two axes in terms that separated these two: parental obedience and trust in others. So this was his first cultural map in 1993. Then in collaboration with Ron Engelhardt, this map expanded to include 8 or 9 religious cultural clusters. So this next map included not only Catholic Protestants, but many, many, many other religions around the world. In 1996, Ron Engelhardt and him accepted an invitation to the Lawrence Harrison to the 1985 conference on culture change that was organized first in Costa Rica, entitled "Underdevelopment is a State of Mind: Culture Matters." The premise of the conference was based on the view of two opposing logics of progress: progress-prone cultures and progress-resistant cultures. The whole idea made Miguel very uncomfortable, and Ron and him continued to work on this cultural map in successive conference on cultural change. In 2006, he was hired to do a survey to measure progress-prone and progress-resistant values. So as a result of this ongoing work, he was invited to become director of the Institute of Cultural Change, CCI, at the Fletcher School of Tufts. His work at the CCI convinced him that the Harris vision of two cultures was wrong, and that we had to rethink the whole idea of what cultural progress really means. The result of all this work is The World in Three Cultures, which now Miguel will be telling us about. Miguel, did I get it right, or do you want to add anything else to what I said?
You did it just wonderful, and you made me think about how I have arrived to the World of Three Cultures. So I have to thank you for that. Okay, so let me begin by saying that it's really an honor to be with you. It's such a distinguished group, and I'm flattered when I found that Daniel Kahneman had been in this position last year. So I really admire his work. And I thank Mauricio because it was a wonderful discover in Sevilla, finding him and Ramon Riera, your colleague from Barcelona, that is also an amazing guy. I am a political scientist, and I never thought that the work that I've done could be of any interest for psychology. But maybe you are not familiar with the name Ron Engelhardt. He's been coordinating the World Values Survey since 1990. We've been working together, and we are covering around 100 countries every 5 years. So it is probably the largest data file around the world it's a survey about 300 questions on human values. And all what I'm going to share comes from that, and from the fact that I studied in England, being a Mexican, and I experienced such a strong culture shocks. But let me share what it is. And let me ask you to begin. Can you see the from the cover of the book?
Yes, I think it's coming across.
Okay. The picture that you are looking there, it shows three hands, and in a way is conveying the meaning. Rock, paper, scissors. And as that play, it is very difficult to say what is best. Rock can be grabbed by paper, paper is cut by scissors, and so you enter into a difficult decision, what is better. And in a way, that's what happened with cultures, honor, achievement, and joy. Let me go, Okay. What this book does is to study the evolution of values, culture, and behavior from an empirical perspective. In our field, you have three authors in 1980, Hofstede, that from, he was asked by IBM in the 1970s, the largest corporation around the world, because they had a problem. They were training their staff all over the world exactly the same way, but they began noticing that people didn't behave the same way. And then through survey research, Hofstede was asked to explain what was the difference. And Hofstede came to the conclusion that it was culture. Although the training was the same, the local culture was compressing the behavior of individuals. And he found four axes: individualism, collectivism, number two, power distance, number three, uncertainty avoidance, and number four, masculinity, femininity. The names are a little bit difficult, but his ideas are very, very powerful. And in management science, he's one of the most influential guys today. A few years later, in 86, I came to this idea that Mauricio was referring of three very powerful values: trust in others, hard work, and autonomy, which I derive from the parental obedience. But I was just presenting a hypothesis, really. I had to wait until 1993 that the second World Value Survey came, and my hypothesis that those three axes were very powerful, because that's what I found was the main explanation of Protestant and Catholics. I had to wait until 93 to come to an empirical answer. But let me tell you how it is that I came to these culture shocks that made me think so much on the difference between Catholics and Protestants. When I first arrived in England in 1973 for my master's degree, I had to get my driver's license, and then I went to ask for it. And the lady in the license office asked me, "Do you have one in Mexico?" And I say, "Yes." "And is it valid?" "Yes." And then she said, "Okay, you can go out and drive." And I said, "How? Don't you need me to show the driver's license?" And she looked at me as saying, "What?" And then I said, or do you need a letter from the ambassador? "Come on, get off. You already told me." When she said that, I was shocked that my word had such a power. And I just couldn't understand, and I went out. The second one was in 1980, when I just arrived in LSE in London. And the first seminar, I volunteered to present it, and then I have never been in the seminar because in Mexico is not the way of teaching. And then when I finished my presentation, the guy at the left say, no, I don't like what Miguel said. I think he's wrong. And in that minute, my blood started boiling. I stopped listening. I just wanted to take that guy out and start fighting. But then the girl on the right said, no, I did like what Miguel said. I think he has a point and so on. And then the one in front says, well, I like some things and I don't like some others. I began cooling down, listening again. By the end of the discussion, I had learned better than when I just came in. So those kind of culture shocks began repeating and repeating. And that made me realize that there has to be an explanation. And that's how I came, okay, the explanation is the difference between Catholics and Protestants. Protestants give a lot of value to hard work. They give a lot of value to truth and many other aspects that I began building up. Now, let me see if I can, yes, I can expand this. What is showing here is the first culture map of 1993 that shows in the vertical axis, trust on the top, distrust on the bottom, and in the horizontal axis, you see autonomy on the right and obedience on the left. And what is so interesting is that you found Protestants on the upper right corner being trustful and autonomous, whereas on the left bottom hand side, you have Catholics, Orthodox, and Muslims, obedient and distrustful. But when we came, well, when I came to this map in 1993, it was horribly impolite to talk about religions and attach any kind of consequences to that. So that was how I came to that, and that was it. In 93, I was doing survey research in Mexico. I was introducing polling, and I used to teach a class since 1974, just one class, so I was not an academic. But from time to time, I kept going back and forth from university. But in 1993, I was in the middle of the transition to democracy in Mexico. Anyhow, the next step in the research of values comes from Schwartz. He's a psychologist from the Hebrew University in Israel. And Schwartz has developed a wonderful, he's a social psychologist. He has developed a wonderful framework, and his ideas are very much influential nowadays. And in 1987, he came to this idea of a psychological structure. And in 87, he presented four axes, as you can see here. And then what he began doing, let me try to, on these compass rows, he gave progressive as against patriotic, idealistic against materialistic, bourgeois against alternative greens, fun and action against religions, and then they illustrate with these photographs. I think this captures, summarizes the powerful of Schwartz's ideas, but he kept working, and at this level, he was on the individual level, looking into individual psychology. But as he moved into countries, he collapsed his four axes into three. And then he and I were coincident on that. Now, let me show you. This is the 1997 world culture map that Mauricio was referring to, where you can see eight regions: Protestant Europe, Protestant English, Catholic Europe, Confucians, Orthodox, Islamic, Latin America, and Africa. So here we began to find that there were clusters of countries based on their values. And for a long time, I was okay with this. Engelhardt had proposed that people, when they are in difficult economic conditions, you have a materialistic outlook. You are concerned mainly on survival needs. But as the country improves economically, or the family improves economically, or yourself improves economically, then you solve all your basic needs and you begin moving forward to post-materialistic needs. That is the idea that Engelhardt used behind this map. In this map, he made a vertical axis with traditional values in the bottom and secular rational values on the top. And on the horizontal axis, you have survival values here and self-expression values, abundance, on the right. And that's what it comes. Okay. The interesting thing when we had this framework is that we began to be able not only to have the whole picture, let me very rapidly show you what are the values that you can associate to that, to the picture that I show you first, the clusters of countries. And then here, what you can see is what are the values related to those. And you can see, for instance, on the top, on the secular area, abortion is okay, determination is okay, free responsibility, divorce is okay, interest in politics, politics is important, and so on. If you go to the traditional side on the bottom, religion is important, God is important, obedience, national pride, work is important, respect of authority, family is important. In the left-hand side, on the survival, women needs children, not happy, respect for rejection of outgroups, state is responsible, child need both parents, hard work, and so on. And if you go to the postmodern side, you see life satisfaction, good health, effect balance, imagination, homosexuality, it's okay, trust in people, tolerance, ecology, and so on. So once you have kind of the picture of what values can be linked to all those regions, we began also looking in how countries changed throughout time. And you can see, for instance, West Germany here moving from 81 to 97, a big jump. You can see East Germany from 90 to 97, Japan, the Netherlands, Iceland, Belgium, France, Italy, and so on. But you could also see changes on the reverse, like China in 1990 and China in 95, or Russia in 90 and Russia in 95, moving in the opposite direction. Or you see here Mexico moving forward, the US almost staying flat, 81 to 95, Ireland becoming more traditional, slightly Brazil, much more traditional, Nigeria almost with no move. So we began finding that values actually changed a lot. Why? Because people is absorbing what is happening in their surroundings, and then by multiplying that by the thousand, by the millions, that changes culture. Also, we began tracking what happens with age. And you can see here in some countries, this is West Germany, the older than 65 are very much in the middle of the chart, and the younger 18, 24 are very much in the top. Sweden is on the right. Spain moved enormously the young, from the old people to the young people, Great Britain and so on. But if you go to Zimbabwe, Pakistan, Nigeria, Tanzania, you see that you cannot find the same pattern that you see in the other countries. Let me share the next. With all what I have shown you is when we were working on the two values, the two cultures, but I was not comfortable. As Mauricio said, when Larry Harrison was proposing so strongly that it was only progress prone and progress resistant, I began thinking hard on that. And finally, the third axis came about, and we could have an economic axis, the vertical one, the horizontal one, a political axis, and then a social axis that would give depth. And you needed an axiological cube to be able to represent the three axes. And what I did, because of the three authors, Hofstede, Engelhardt, and Schwartz, that were better established. Schwartz was the one, and I borrow his terminology. And what you see in this queue is that the six walls that show on the left wall, harmony, and the right wall, dominance, the economic axis that goes from harmony with nature to dominance of nature. In the social, you see imbricancy in the front and autonomy in the back. And on the political axis, you see in the bottom hierarchy and on the top equality. When I found that, I began sensing that countries throughout history had moved from the corner of the left side, the bottom left side, to the top right side, and the bottom being honor, the cultures of honor that places a lot of importance on hierarchy and authority and obedience and respect for authorities, to the corner of success, of achievement, that the economic rationality is in that corner, where it is more important than above all economic success and material achievement. So you could trace that countries, as they evolve, were moving into that direction, and the World of Three Cultures, the book, is the outcome of those reflections. So let me make a summary of how the 35 years of culture change can be summarized. Again, in 1990, Hofstede presents his four axes. In 1986, I present my three axes on a hypothetical level. In 87, Schwartz, four axes. In 93, the map, my map, two axes. Schwartz in 94 moves to three axes. In 2000, Engelhardt, two axes. And in 2015, with the book, I show the three axes. The three axes are one economic, one political, one social. The names that we three use are different. The disciplines we come from are different, but the findings are the same. And so that gave me confidence that it was something that was well-based. Now, this triangle, what shows is that when you are talking as an individual or as a country, we humans, Homo sapiens began on a corner of honor. Why? You see, in this triangle, you have here joy, here honor, here achievement. Historically speaking, Homo sapiens began in the culture of honor. Why? Because it was an evolutionary advantage to be behind your leader. Whatever was the alpha male that was stronger, was faster, was a better hunter, that group had an evolutionary advantage. So all that help, that arrangement was good. And that's the beginning of the honor societies, where loyalty, authority, obedience, it was the main thing. We were into that mood all the way up to the Industrial Revolution. So since agriculture was, first since we began as hunter-gatherers, and then when we moved to agriculture, and then all the way up to the 18th century, when the Industrial Revolution came, then you had a big change in values that moved the triangle from that, and it moved so that the economic rationality prevailed, and then achieving the material success was the most important one. And the other two, the political motivation of honor or the social motivation of joy, were subordinated to the economic motivation of achievement. But that worked for almost two centuries until the two world wars of the 20th century, that particularly after the second, the Nordic, began asking, what is the point or killing yourself working when you sacrifice everything else? Life is not only about work, it's also, what about a bit of joy? And then the Nordics began searching for joy. And that's how they came, they tried to balance life, quality of life, better, family and friends. But what they were intellectually seeking, it happened that the colonial Catholics had it all the time, a culture of joy. Why? It's an accident of history. In this triangle, what I try to show is that you don't have ideal types only. In joy, you can place Italy and Spain, that's from the data. in the Protestant, the achievement corner, you have the Nordic Protestants, and in the honor corner, you have the Islamic world. But in between the achievement and honor, you have Texas in the US, Asian countries, Christian Orthodox. Between honor and joy, you have Indian Buddhists, you have Latin America, or between joy and achievement, you have Massachusetts, or France, or California, or Southern Europe. So, all this, as I said, was thinking about countries. But after the Sevilla conference, I began thinking, this could also be used in psychology at the individual level. And the honor, joy, and achievement has different drivers, different periods in history, and different priorities. And the time they were prevalent are different as well. In honor, the main driver is political, is the state. Whereas in joy, the main driver is the family, is a social concern. And in achievement, the main driver is the economy, is the market. The period, as I mentioned, are in the past history, all the way to the World War II, particularly when the big change and achievement began with the Industrial Revolution. In terms of priorities, for honor, it is dominance, it is traditions, what is most important. In joy, it is human relations and well-being, and in achievement, it is wealth, efficiency, punctuality. The prevalence, as I mentioned, you can see clearly honor in the ancient empires, achievement in the modern empires, and joy in the Catholic Buddhists. Okay, so this in a way is the summary of the world of three cultures. And I would like to stop here and then build the rest with your concerns and questions.
I have a question.
Maurice.
Yeah, thank you, first of all. It's really quite interesting. I don't know this area of work at all, but the other day, and we've all read surveys of this kind, I think they're conducted by the United Nations, which rate countries in terms of their population's degree of happiness. And invariably, the Nordic countries rate very high. I think Finland was the highest. Now, there must be, I assume, some relationship between joy and ratings of happiness. And I wondered, I wonder what you thought about those surveys and how they relate to your categorizations.
Oh yes, Maurice, thank you. When we began working on this happiness index, we were flattered that it began attracting attention in many places. And as you know, the King of Bhutan established a happiness index that rather than measuring the GDP, gross domestic product, he's measuring the gross happiness index of the country. And United Nations became interested, Jeffrey Sachs became involved, the World Bank, the Gallup organization. So there are several exercises trying to measure happiness. The way that we ask the question in the World Value Survey is, tell me, are you very happy, somehow happy, not very happy, not happy at all, period, without explaining what happening happiness is. So there are some limitations. So we don't give any clue of what we are asking. We want to ask you, how happy do you feel with your life? Okay. Whereas what you have in most of the other exercises is that you have a composed index that measure if you have job, house, food, the city where you live is clean, is beautiful, is so. There are many elements that are defining what happiness is, rather than asking people simply if you are happy or you're not. Now, we found two problems on this. Number one, in some countries of the world, people tend to go to the extremes. If you measure on scales from 0 to 10, there are countries that tend to go to the extremes, or very good and very bad. Mm-hmm. But some, and those is Latin America clear. But you have others that goes to the center, and those are the Asians. So we have survey researchers have to start taking that into account in order to calibrate what the scale really is measuring. Number two, in some countries, there is no translation for happiness. Particularly, I'm thinking on German. You don't have a word for happiness.
It's interesting in itself, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, okay, taking all this into account, I think it's a better way of measuring. Now, the most interesting thing that when you ask simply the question the way we ask, the countries that come on the top are African countries and Latin American countries. Number one, Tanzania. Number two, Mexico. On the question of happiness. And the ones at the bottom, the Nordic countries. Hmm. Now, but that is the answer. I don't have, let me, give me just a sec. I could. Happiness. I'll give you in a few minutes that.
Sure.
But okay, that would be, I'm very glad that United Nations and World Bank and many more organizations are paying attention to happiness. Others use well-being. I think what they are measuring really is well-being more than happiness. But The important thing of that is that economists and the economy are moving from this capitalism that went so far in terms of consumer excesses and inequality in the distribution of income and wealth throughout the countries. Now you have kind of the pendulum going all the way back, and they are paying attention to well-being, so that the economy should not be only to get more material goods for people, but taking care of the well-being of the whole people. Thank you, Morris.
Thank you.
No. Okay. Any other question?
I have a question, Miguel.
Yes, Mark.
So I've been reading the 14th century Muslim scholar Ibn Khaldun. And he was a historian, and he came from a aristocratic family, And then he, when the Catholics started taking over Spain, he had to move back to northern, to Tunisia, to northern Africa. And he had diplomatic positions, and he was a scholar. He was a, sort of, I think of him as a counterpart in Muslim culture to what Machiavelli is in Occidental culture. But leaving that in, that aside for a minute, what Ibn Khaldun discovered was that he observed that periodically in the north coast of Africa, which was rich agricultural areas, the big cities developed. And toward the north, there was a natural geographic barrier that had to do with the desert people, you know, which is clearly, by the way, a culture of honor, you know. And those nomadic desert people were fierce warriors with a very strong culture of honor and very cohesive. So what he noticed that every hundred few years or so, the agricultural societies would start to develop greater economic inequalities, and the cohesion of society would start breaking down. And though even they had larger armies and this walled cities and much more powerful armies, once the social fabric of society started falling apart, the honor societies of the north would come, invade them, and they would impose their own values of equality. And after a few hundred years, though, there would be starting to be fights among one group and the other of the privilege as social solidarity would start breaking down. He called that asibaya, social solidarity. And his view is that societies survive or perish depending on the degree of social solidarity that they can maintain. You know, in this case, it was the experiment of Africa, but a number of people have gone to study this, in other words, and what happened, say, to the Roman Empire, where you see also the gradual breakdown of social solidarity and the bordering areas of the world, you know, the barbarians taking over and so forth. So you can start looking at history. So here's my question to you. So how would you put this issue of increasing degrees of economic disparities, sometimes brutal disparities, the social fabric starting to break down, and the breakdown leading to civilizations and countries and like the Romans starting to break down. Where would that axis form, and what does social solidarity fit into your way of looking at cultural values?
Very interesting question, as always. You pose interesting problems, Mauricio. Okay, let me begin by saying that as you were developing your narrative, you made me think of two experiences. Number one, the collapse of the Roman Empire by the entrance of Christianism. Talking about when social cohesion, which is glued by an ideology that everybody shared, when that is shattered, as happened with when Christianism began entering the Roman Empire, then they began questioning about the gods that they had believed always, and that weakening of the belief system leads to the weakening of cohesion and then the falling apart, in that case, of the Roman Empire. The second idea that you reminded me was something that the president of the university in Costa Rica shared in that conference of 95 that you mentioned. In that president used to be I think with one of the American organizations in Tunisia, I think it was. And part of his mission was to bring the Bedouin people, the people, the nomads in the desert, to bring them closer to his agency. But there was a Bedouin group that was very difficult. And then he had an idea of asking the leader of that tribe to invite him for a few days at their campment or wherever they were living in the desert. And it is known that the Arab tribes, if you are their guest, they are wonderful with you and they take great care of you. So he spent a few days with them and he was very gladly with them and very well treated and fed. And then he asked the leader that he wanted to return the favor, and he wanted to invite him and whoever he wanted to come with to Paris, where was the headquarters of this organization. And then the Bedouin leader went to Paris, and when he returned, the Bedouin leader was completely shocked. He couldn't understand how it is that the infidels, the Western people, were living already in paradise with water and beautiful plants and flowers and all of that. Whereas the good ones, the Muslims in the desert, were living in hell. I recall that when he told us about that experience, that was, remember, in the framework of that conference on cultural change. But because ideas can change so rapidly, you can move people and you can move tribes and you can move countries. And let me connect with something before I go back to the breaking of social cohesion. Cultures are changing every day, slowly, very gradually, but also can change suddenly when you have a big tragedy like what we are going through right now. The pandemic has the potential of making a shift as deep as maybe the World War that impacted so much in so many people in so many countries that produced a change of values. Now, the pandemic has that potential of changing values. Which way, I don't know. That's something that I've been thinking and thinking. Now, let me make a connection with your field of psychology. The three cultures that I was presenting to you, how does that relate to your field? When you are, those of you that maybe in clinical work and therapies with
it's
patients,
7 o'clock.
What you can think is that is not because everybody is being impacted by the surrounding culture. You cannot treat the same way and you cannot develop the same theories for people in the cultures of honor or people in the cultures of achievement, because they may be responding exactly the opposite way. What in cultures of achievement, the US particularly, but all Western Europe, Nordic Europe particularly, but the US is the prototypical case. Sending your parents to an institution on their old age is a sign of respect and care. That is exactly the opposite in the honor culture, where that is really shameful. families have to keep their parents, the caring of their old parents. Now, as I was thinking, talking to you, I was realizing you have to keep in mind that it depends what kind of patient you have. The axiological framework, the values, the value system that is present them is different in each of the three cases. Now, you're asking me how the breaking of cohesion, of social cohesion, goes with the framework of values that we've been developing. That is a good question. And I don't think that I have an answer right now, but I'm gonna think about it and I will send you a line. This is the fourth time that you give me a homework, but I'm very glad of that. Thank you, Mauricio.
Can I ask another question?
Please.
Two questions. One is an observation. It occurred to me when you were talking about the different perspectives of large groups and polls with countrywide and so on. And then there's, of course, the perspective of the individual, which most of us, those are the phenomena one deals with. But one of the things that occurred to me, and I was wondering whether there's any work in this area, that is really another way of defining marginality. That is, if you get a culture that, let's say, you characterized as an honor culture or an achievement culture, what happens to those individuals who have value systems and patterns of behavior that deviate markedly from that dominant set of values? That could be both positive and negative in the sense of leading a culture to change, but also having a marginal status in the culture. And I'm wondering if that's one way of placing in a cultural framework the way we define deviation, including abnormality of functioning. I don't know if I've made that clear.
Sure, sure. And I love your question because that's my case. I was born in a very small town in the Gulf of Mexico. It used to have 25,000 people when I was born. So it was a tiny little town. And it was an agricultural, it was kind of a European enclave that I didn't know when I was living there. And I went to school all the way to secondary school, and for high school I moved to Mexico City. And wow, that was a huge change from my 25,000 people town to the, I think Mexico was about 5 million in those years, 1963. But I recall how I am an obsessive of punctuality and of making good use of time. And that is not the way the Mexican and the Latin and the joy cultures perform. I mean, who cares about time? I mean, well, you arrive at whenever you arrive, and that's okay, and nobody gets mad because of that. Of course, nothing functions, and I felt myself very uncomfortable in those days. So when I had a chance to go to study in England, and everything was working properly, and it was everything on time, I couldn't believe the kind of joy that I developed from something as simple as being on time. Mm-hmm. But that showed me that, okay, let me tell you more about that. I returned to Mexico. I was working for many years in government and then on survey research. And in 95, I had the chance to move then to Michigan. And I was so glad of going back to work in an environment that everything works and is on time and you don't have unpunctuality. But then I began to sense that that also had other extremes. Nobody interrupts when you are at work, but also nobody interrupts when you're at home. And then in Mexico, of course, you are working and your friend comes and start chatting, or you got a call and nobody cares. And if you are at home, your cousins and your nephews and the 1,000 relatives, you can organize a big party in a couple of hours and everybody jumps. And you know when they arrive, but you cannot manage when they leave. And of course, completely different to inviting you a dinner in the US from 7 to 9, sharp. So after a few years of that experience, I began missing my Mexican way of socializing. And I came to the conclusion that the US was a beautiful, exuberant working environment, but it was a desert, a social desert. You had practically no interactions with friends, spontaneous interactions, chaotic interactions. Whereas in Mexico, it was a jungle, exuberant jungle of social interactions and a desert of working habits. So it's completely what you were saying, that you have a psychological structure that could be completely opposite to the structure of the culture you are living in. But in a way, what happens is that it's not only a matter of that the majority shares those values. It is also a consequence of religion, of the legal system, and of the history in which a culture develops. But finally, the culture gets formed and you are swimming in that culture. That's why that beautiful saying that fish can't see water. And that's what happened to me. When I was in Mexico, I didn't notice it. When I went out to live in England, at the beginning I thought, oh, these English are absolutely crazy because they were very different. But as I found the pattern repeatedly, I said, no, it has to have an explanation. Yeah. And that's when I became involved in studying the different cultures. But you are absolutely right in your observation, Maurice.
You know, your account reminds me of something quite funny. Many years ago, I lived next door to some friends who both of them went to Yale Law School and had become very successful, and they moved into an apartment on Riverside Drive and so on, and they decided to have a cocktail party, and they invited their immigrant Jewish families. And I remember when they told me about it, I kind of predicted what would happen. They sent out invitations inviting their relatives to a cocktail party, and it said, come between 4 and 6. And they got no responses. And so they called a couple of their relatives. Why didn't you respond to our invitation? And the answer was, you think we're going to respond to an invitation that tells us when we have to leave? It says become 4 and 6. You mean we have to get up and leave at 6 o'clock? That's terrible. We're not going to come. So that's a wonderful example of misjudging a culture. And I knew that was going to happen because my relatives would have done the same.
Good. I found the table on the feeling of happiness. The top countries Nigeria, Tanzania, Mexico, Venezuela, Salvador, Puerto Rico. Those are the happiest countries in the world. And then the bottom ones, you have Romania, Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine, Russia, Moldova, Armenia. So the Nordics are just above the former Soviet countries. But that's a picture. Any other question or comment?
Hi there. I have a question. This is Valita Dent. Thank you so much for this discussion. I find it very, very interesting, especially given the context of what's going on right now in America. So I'm wondering, you know, I'm trying to sort of piece together in my mind the relevance of the models that you presented to the civil unrest and the response to the broader sense that, you know, racism is a dominant sort of institutional framework that this country has operated and built its success on for many, many, many years. So I'm wondering if you have a sense of the relationship to the models that you talked about to what's going on right now.
You said between racism and...
Yeah, so, you know, the sense that the protests that are happening all across America right now are predicated on the fact that racism is one of the founding principles of this country. And it is, in a sense, built into all of the institutional frameworks that we operate, economic, educational, health, and medical. And so, you know, it seems to me that it's a fundamental part of our culture, at least if you listen to those who are very outspoken with relationship to these movements, these political movements and these social and equity movements, that's the sense. And so I was just wondering if you see any connections between the models that you've developed and that you've been talking with us about tonight, which deal with culture, and the shift that we see happening right now. And I do believe there is a shift going on. I just can't really define it.
That's a difficult question.
I know. I don't think there's an answer, but, you know, I thought we could talk about it anyway.
I really thank you, because it's challenging. But let me give you my first reaction, just thinking aloud. I think people is fed up, really fed up. Let me make a connection to the end of World War II. The greatest minds of that time were in charge of rebuilding the international system. And that's how John Maynard Keynes, the economist, came to suggest the ideas that would build institutions and would care for improving the way of life of the millions and millions of people. That had an outcome that improved income equality and produced a lot of progress at the individual level. And those were the years from the end of the 40s, 47, to around 75. That the US was really improving a lot. And of course, the common people may not know what is going on, but they feel it. They feel that they are getting better economically, and the service they receive, and the education, and the access to university, and to health systems, and so on. But always keeping in mind that the US is one of the most traditional countries in the world compared to the level of development. I think it's important. Let me share you in the map. Let me show you where the US appears so low. What's going on here? Let me show you. The US in the culture map appears very low. Here it is, the US. It's almost the opposite to China. China is culturally very advanced, Japan even more, to the level of development. But in the case of China, the level of development is low because it's very close to the survival edge, whereas the US is very close to the abundance edge. But look how the US is so low in the traditional. What happens is that the US kept a very strong portion of people that is extremely superstitious and deeply fundamentalist on the Protestant side, and that produced that by the mid-70s, the original ideology of sharing and improving everybody began changing for immediate gratification, excessive consumerism, and getting a bigger house, a bigger car, a newer car, and very much driven by material things acquisition. But of course, without solving the horrible segregation with the African-American people, that kept a level of inequality that was already there. But beginning the 1980s, the inequality of the US rocketed. So in the last 40 years, that inequality has been gaining traction, and the policymakers feel completely, because the ideology is there, they feel no shame on doing what I feel myself so injured, for instance, with what the American system has done to students, to charge them and making to leave university with a huge debt. I mean, but the policymakers feel okay. I mean, what's the problem? So there was a change on ideology that began dripping down on policy, as this that I mentioned on students, also the lack of care on the healthcare system that you are seeing now of so many policymakers wanting to repeal Obamacare. And who cares if 20 million people lose their insurance? Who cares? If you don't do it with your own resources, it's your problem. If you die, it's your problem. So it's a lack of solidarity that in a way reflects what Mauricio and Maury were saying about social cohesion. So right now, you had in 2008 a smaller version of what we are seeing today. I could think of three more or less similar occasions. In 1968, when the student movement fired all over the world from what had begun in Paris. Those days, communications were not that good and whatever, but it was impressive the way that the student movement propagated throughout the world. The second one, I'm thinking on the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2009, 2010. The financial and economic crisis of that year was awful, was predictable, was, it was the mortgage that broke, and the banks and institutions that had the shares and all the assets that could have prevented, they didn't care. They said, okay, I don't want to carry this burden, send it out. It will infect the whole world. It will break the world economy, but I prefer everybody broke, not myself. And that is a second example. And now we have the third. Really, the killing in Minnesota, that is just the last drop of a succession of what has been happening. And I would say it's kind of an anger that was refrained on people all over, and kind of enough is enough, and it broke all over the world. Now, how do you connect these to the structure of values? Because you can see in Europe, in Latin America, all over. So it doesn't seem to be that much modified by being honor or achievement or joy culture. I would tend to feel that these kind of are more basic instincts, more basic reactions going to kind of the primitive response. But I have a second homework today on your question, Valida.
I want to comment on this. Can I do that and have you respond?
Who is Doris?
Yes. It seems to me the wrong dimension was used. The traditional notion in our country is law and order. In 68, when we had all sorts of conflict over the Vietnam War with a lot of protests and riots, Nixon was able to achieve his goal by saying, law and order. I think Trump thought it would work currently. Of course, it's not working, but essentially the traditional idea in this country for the majority of people has been no chaos, but law and order. And racism got squelched by law and order.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting angle, absolutely. It's interesting also that, as you said, whereas it worked in Nixon, it doesn't seem to be working today. What has changed?
I think social values have altered enormously in a very brief time. I think technology, being able to actually see what's happening with Black people, has mobilized us. And so we're more sophisticated than we were in 1968.
And on top of that, social media has changed things dramatically. I can think on the Arab Spring that in a few hours almost, social media was able to gather thousands and thousands of people in protests that brought down a full government, something that was unimaginable in Egypt. it does not mean that they really achieved much, but it showed the potency of social media and very much the reactions all over the world that we have seen today, much faster than the student movement of 1968 were mobilized, particularly by social media. That's something that is also changing very much. Mauricio.
I think Tatiana was first.
Tatiana. Quita el micrófono, Tani. Your mic.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. You know, I was wondering, like, I just saw the documentary 13th. Have you seen it? Yes. So I was wondering if the reason why at the beginning, like when slavery ended and people saw there was an opportunity to continue their business and continue profiting from a group, so they, is the reason why it happened in the United States and not in another part of the world, does it have to do with the fact that this group valued at this thing of accumulating wealth more than maybe honor, more than the social relationships, like you've been saying? And so whichever group they're able to exploit, that would make money, and that's the reason why maybe that it became ingrained, you know, ingrained and pervasive, and so it does filter into the education system and everything of unfairness, because it's making money, right? It was being allowed, and people, and it was difficult to see it, and now we're able to see it because of social media, but it was really hidden for, I suppose, well, at least I didn't, until I saw the documentary, although I felt I knew about race quite a lot, I didn't understand it was so intentional that, you know, the putting people in jail that way was so intentional, intentionally exploiting Latinos and African Americans and for money.
I basically agree because the rationale is profiting, is making money any way you can, and that is okay as long as you get the money that you were targeting to. And so if it is profiting from students or profiting from African Americans or from Hispanics, of course, the weaker part is the easier part, because and then you have to say, no, that's the way the system works, it's nothing personal. But really, when you looked into the way that the system is working, is biased in one direction. And that's something that the American society really, really has to work very hard on that. Mauricio.
Yeah, I'm going back to the question we're trying to figure out about where would this whole issue of social solidarity fit in terms of this discussion. So here's a thought, and I want you to tell me what you think, Miguel, that for either of these cultures, a success, joy, or honor to work, there has to be a degree of social solidarity. And that social solidarity basically depends on fairness and trust. You know, if the degree of a brutal inequality begin to exist, going back to Khaldun, no society can survive for very long. It survives with civil wars or more turmoil and descends to failed states or whatever. You know, I think, you know, underlying all these axes, there has to be an axis that keeps, what is the glue that keeps society together? Okay, it can't just be attachment bonds, because that's just family. It has to be some sense of identity with your group, of neutrality to the group, and solidarity with your group. When that breaks down, as it has brutally in the United States, because the culture of success has become the predominant culture as cosmopolitan the United States, you know, and with its logic that of creating, as you said, brutal economic disequality. I think I read somewhere that the United States has the greatest social inequalities of all industrialized country, and it's accelerated since 1980. They're absolutely brutal. So I think what's happening, you know, as you said, is enough is enough. And a young people that have grown up in multicultural societies that are much more accepting of homosexuals, are much accepting of other people, have a cosmopolitan culture as opposed to a rural culture, are the ones that all over the world are saying, you know, not only is this oppression unacceptable, but we have to change the world because we cannot go back to the old normal, because the old normal was deeply broken.
I agree. And let me sharing three reactions to what you say. I agree that identity and solidarity have to be the cohesion that keeps a society united. In the US, what you have is actually six demographic groups. It's number one are the American Indians. They are almost about the same. They are about 55 million each of the groups. American Indians, Hispanics, Afro-Americans. Then it comes in fourth, German descendants. In fifth, it comes English descendants. And the sixth is people from all over the world. So, because the dominant group since the beginning were the English descendants, they framed the Constitution, they framed the Independence Chart, they framed the laws, they framed everything. And of course, in those years, they were not thinking about African Americans as individuals until the Civil War. But it took, even that slavery had been abolished, it took almost to the movements of the 60s and 70s to start progressing on that age. So solidarity and identity is made difficult when you have six different big demographic segments in the country.
Am I on?
Yeah.
You know, a couple of things. One, I don't think we should get that excited about what's going on now, as inspiring as it is. We've been through this before. And when things quiet down, things remain essentially structurally the same.
Agree.
And so, and here I'm wondering whether this would be, the work that you do is not intended for this fine analysis, but it occurs to me that placing America in either honor, joy, or achievement doesn't really reveal the nature of what's going on in our country. And then if you do a finer analysis, it turns out it's very glaring. You have factors like gerrymandering, you have factors like lobbying and government, one and the same. You have factors like racism. You have factors of inequality and the ideology of money and greed. And that becomes a level of analysis that I think one needs to understand America. And if that doesn't, if those don't change, as excited and inspired as we are now, it's perfectly predictable that with some small band-aid changes, we'll revert to exactly where we were. I mean, how many of us remember with the horrible killings, everyone, oh, now there are going to be changes in gun control. Hasn't happened. So I think we shouldn't take our eyes off the kind of structural factors that make the kind of changes that we need so difficult, even impossible in America. And I don't think we should be, it's funny, one talks about being lulled into sleepiness. We shouldn't be lulled into excessive joy by what's going on until these events lead to the kind of changes that I've been describing. I don't think much will change. And that speaks to the necessity, and I wonder what you think about that, of the level of analysis that isn't just up here, you know, joy, honor, achievement, but gets into the gritty-nitty detail of the structure and mechanisms of particular countries and societies.
I basically agree with you that once all the fighting cools down, the status quo prevails and everything comes as business as usual, except that watch out for China now. What our generation has lived, let's say from the middle of last century up to today, has been the US being the dominant figure, international figure, the dominant figure around the world. But the thing now is that similarly to what happened to Britain, to England, by the 1940s, England had no plans of continuing as a world leader because their finances and their situation was very exhausted. And by the end of the Second World War, England was not able to continue as the world leader, and it handed out the leadership to the US. The US, at the end of the war, was not expecting to become the world leader, but someone had to take the steering wheel, and it was the US. The thing now is that something similar is happening to China. China feels not ready to take the steering wheel, but the world development of events is kind of pushing China into that direction. Now, what is sustaining nowadays the American leadership? It's mainly the financial system. The whole of the financial system was, let's say, slightly biased to benefit the US. And that leadership had been taken care of throughout the years with care, but suddenly, particularly with Trump, he doesn't care about international institutions. He doesn't care about that leadership and sustaining the leadership, and in a way is pushing China into the forefront. Now, a big change happened in 1971 when Nixon arrived to the conclusion of the gold standard that was sustaining the dollar was abandoned. And then he thought that the Saudi Arabia oil could substitute gold. And it did. And so the American Treasury was able to begin printing money with no restriction because they didn't have to back it up in gold. And so that's how the bubble economy began. And you had bubbles inflating in all aspects of business. And if the business is not going good, but you have the right connections, the lobbying that you mentioned, and the gerrymandering was very, very functional to keep the kind of politicians in place for taking care of your interests and so on. And then you began having bubbles and bubbles and bubbles. They were not successful. Well, put it more money. Where the money comes from, who cares? but more money among, that's the bubble economy. The thing now is that the pandemic is showing up that that bubble economy is having trouble, because as long as you have one country that is in trouble or one sector of the economy in the US that is in trouble, you can rescue it. But when you have all the countries in the world and all the sectors of the economy in trouble, there may be not enough money to rescue them. And then the central bubble can burst, and that could happen in hours. And of course, China is working on that and is convincing all the countries that are in their area that instead of paying for oil in dollars, they could pay it in yuans, or they could pay it through other ways. If that happens, the predominance of the US could go down very rapidly. And then the going back to the business as usual is going to be very, very difficult. Let me get back to my second idea that Mauricio produced when you were talking, Mauricio. If you measure inequality around the world in terms of the income of the bottom 10% of the population against the income of the top 10% of the population, you have in Japan is the average income of the poorest 10% against the richest 10%. Japan is four times. So the average income of the poorest, as opposed to the average income of the richest, is four times different. You go to Nordic countries, seven times. You come to the US, 15 times. You come to Mexico, 30 times. You go to Brazil, 60 times. So that gives you an idea. Now, these figures are the ones that I mentioned in the book that was finishing 1914. So probably right now, the US may have moved up to 20 times difference. I have not measured. But that level of inequality, people may not know of that, but they feel it. My last comment to Mauricio is that in a way, what the pandemic, what COVID-19 is doing, is showing all these contradictions that were hidden to the naked eye are coming visible. And that's part of all these new processes, these protests, these enough is enough attitude that we are seeing practically all over. Thank you, Mauricio and Maurice.
May I jump in?
Pardon?
May I jump in?
Who is it?
Ray.
I can't find you. Ray, yes.
Okay, good. I had two remarks. I don't know if I can make them clear or not. The first one is the idea that when this pandemic is over, things will go back to normal. There's another force that is even stronger, but a little less immediately visible, and that's climate change. And the young people are certainly very sensitive to it. And the US government is certainly not at all, well, denies it exists, right? It's being wiped out of the websites of the government and so forth. So I think we're facing a much more difficult time ahead, maybe not within our lifetime. Well, we're seeing it in our lifetimes, but the real impact of it is going to hit 50, 60, 70 years from now. Our kids and our grandkids are going to have to live through it. And it's going to be huge amounts of displacement and huge, you know, it has the potential to be the famine and war and the whole, and pestilence, the whole bit, much worse than the world has ever seen, the human world has ever seen. So there's that in the background of all of this that's, I think, coloring it. The other thing I wanted to say was there is this issue of group solidarity, which is very important, I think, as everybody tonight has been acknowledging. The question, there are two issues with it. One is, what groups do you consider yourself to belong to? You know, is it more important to be a Republican than to be a US citizen? Is it more important to be a Catholic than to be an Irish man or something? You know, is it more important to be, I don't know, a Wall Street person as opposed to somebody who cares about society as a whole? And that's really very fluid. And the other aspect of this is that the logic of groups is you're good to the people in your group, but the rest of the world, forget it. And now the question is, when do groups, how do I put this? The parameter among various groups is, how mean are you to people in other groups? Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing an increase in meanness, at least from some groups.
Yeah, very good point, Ray. Let me give you my reactions to that. You are right that the pandemic is terrible, but climate change is worse. Definitely. The thing is that climate change is a process that is slow, that is, their consequences are not so sudden as a pandemic is, but definitely is much more powerful to introduce changes that we cannot even imagine. Now, you talk about something that made me think. I have four kids, the two that are here, the two girls that are in this, two older ones and two younger ones. The younger ones are 33, 34. The older ones are 46, 48. Completely two generations, two different outlooks. But the younger ones made me realize, when we were in the Sevilla conference with my oldest daughter, Tatiana, that is in the conference, because of the orientation of your group and what Ramon, your Catalan colleague, was saying, it made me realize that when I had my eldest children, I used to say that the emotions department was my wife's, and my department was providing. In my generation, that was the dominant idea. I never even thought of emotions can have complications until very recently, and particularly that's been a contribution of my children. But recently, the younger ones began talking to me about how their generation is taking care of the emotions of their pets, of the dogs and cats. And I was kind of shocked when they were explaining me the kind of attention that they are placing on their pets that I didn't place on my kids, the reason of my life, but I never thought of that. And I think that shows a big change in values that is going to affect the way the world behaves. And now that Ray talks of climate change, all the educated and carefulness people, of course, are concerned. But when you elect leaders that are ignorant, that are uneducated, that have no idea of how damaging their position is, that really hurts what happens in a society. I was simply shocked that the US left the Paris Agreement on climate change, that reject the World Health Organization in the middle of the pandemic. So in a way, leaders are very important on that end. Now, the last thing that you mentioned about the group solidarity, if you feel more a Republican or an American or a Wall Street or whatever. One of the readings that sprang in my mind back in the 80s was that difference of Catholics and Protestants. And I came across to a double code of ethics that goes exactly in the direction of what you mentioned. And the utmost example of that double ethical code is the mafias. As you may know, in Italy, the mafia is a very honorable structure. They take very good care of the family, of the town, of the church, and with their in-group, they display one code of ethics, impeccable. But out of the group, they can do whatever it is. It's the law of the jungle. So your idea of these double ethics is completely, completely clear. I completely agree. Thank you, Ray. Any other question?
Yes, hi, thank you.
Danielle,
yes. So I wanted to ask you about how globalization has influenced your study. I wanted to know a little bit more, if you could say a few words about the methodology. You talked about the value system differing among different cultures, and we talk about countries as if they're unified and one thing. But we know that with globalization and with migration, so many peoples now exist in different countries. And I imagine that with the years, that this has become much more diverse, countries have become more diverse, more immigrants, more migrants. So can we really speak about a value system of one country that represents that country when these countries have so much diversity within them, especially today, as we have more and more globalization?
Very good point, Danielle. Let me give you my reactions. You ask about the methodology. You mean to the way we gather data?
Yes, and how you defined the terms that you knew that different countries were responding to the same thing, so that you could make these comparisons. That was my first question. The second one has to do with globalization.
Okay. In terms of the methodology, is the standard methodology of survey research. We develop a master questionnaire that is the same to all the around 100 countries. We have a central committee that coordinates everything, not in one single country, Englehart in Michigan, and then we have the questionnaire group in Turkey, the others in France, and others in Finland, others in Spain, myself, so all over the world. Now, the central group has the national correspondents in all the 100 countries that are normally academics from university research departments that they take care of getting the funding in their country and selecting the best organization that can conduct the survey research, translating the questionnaire. Of course, the questionnaires has been translated since the 1980s. And so the same questionnaire are the same questions. It's very difficult to take a question out or to add one question, but that happens. And it's a very long questionnaire. It's about 1 hour interview, about 300 questions. So in the whole world, it's exactly the same. The local representative is the one that has to be taking care that the translations are functional translations, not literal translations, and so to guarantee the validity of what we are comparing. The surveys are roughly around 1,000 respondents. All the selections is mathematical selection, so all the standard procedures for survey research. So every 5 years we gather about 100 surveys, and the central bank that you can access online is in Madrid in Spain, and you can pull up any country, any variable, any question, and you can compare and do all. We try to be as friendly as possible to give this information to academics. Now, your question on globalization, we have a question that said, where do you feel you belong to? The town where you were born, the state, the region, the country, the continent, or the world as a whole? This question is one that has been, there are five questions that call my attention that in the 20 years period, the last time that I checked, I have not been checking that question so much, but I compare the 1980 with 2000, and the five questions, the five values that has changed the most. Number one, acceptance of homosexuality, which is very important. That is the strongest predictor of democracy. And that has improved all over the world. Yeah. The second, rejection of corruption. So that is also a very, at least for me, very positive outcome. The third is a reduction on the ideal of family size. Also a great news of reduction of population, let me recall. The fourth is moving from the town where I was born to the world as a whole. So what you see is that the trend to globalization has been growing. And I'm talking, the numbers that I am sharing with you are 1980 to 2000. Probably from 2000 to today, that has increased in terms of globalization. Okay, so we have been measuring that. Now, your last question about if a value system responds for the whole country. Obviously not. So we take the 1,000 sample.
It's 8 o'clock.
The 1,000 sample, and of course, what we share are the averages of the country. But you have to see, and you can, because the information is there, you can see the dispersion that you have in questions. So where you have everybody agreeing on that, or where you have a huge disagreeing, and then you can go to, okay, age differences, gender differences, education differences, income differences, and then you see all the variety. There are not enough cases. You could look, for instance, the US is clearly achievement in the North, particularly the Northeast, is honor in the South. The border with Mexico are honor cultures, and you'll have joy cultures in the coasts. California, Florida particularly. So, okay, you have that blending of cultures within a country, but in a way, when you present polling and you contrast countries in the world polling, nonetheless, you have the difference that are shown in the data that are shared. Okay, I think it's 8 o'clock and I have no problem and continue if you want to continue.
Well, thank you. It's a wonderful presentation. If there aren't any more questions too, I want to thank you for presenting to the group. Can't have everyone clapping all at once, but
I did. It was
terrific. Really appreciate your presence.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was wonderful being with you. Thank you for your questions.
And of course, you're invited for the entire weekend as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And I hope in the weekend, maybe we can go to some issues and bring up, if it's possible, to bring up some of the issues that were discussed today during the course of the weekend.
Sure. Thank you, Mauricio. Okay.
How would we do it?
Very nice. Thank you. Take care.
All right. I'll open that up at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning for people to get on for 9. We'll start at 9 o'clock.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.